from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, decluttering. It's almost a requisite New Year's resolution, whether it be your desk or your closet. So why is it so hard to stick to it? In this hour of Forum, we'll get expert tips on clearing out the clutter in your home or workspace, talk the latest decluttering strategies, and even the psychology behind our need to purge and store. Join us with your questions next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. In this second hour forum, we're going to talk decluttering. It's often on our to-do lists as we embark on a new year. But even when we're successful at organizing our spaces, we can find it's hard to keep it that way. Or maybe we decide we're perfectly happy with our piles, thank you very much. Yet why do some people report life changes or spiritual epiphanies when they've successfully winnowed down stacks of paper or organized their sock drawer? In this hour forum, we bring together organizing experts to share their strategies for decluttering those stubbornly messy spaces in our lives and examine our drive to accumulate. And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. What are your experiences with clutter? What are you trying to organize or winnow down? Let me tell you who's joining us. Victoria Roberts Russell of Victoria Roberts Organizing. She's a professional organizer. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here, Victoria Roberts Russell. Deborah Beda is also with us, another professional organizer with Liberated Spaces. She's been an organizer for more than 8 years and specializes in green organizing. Good morning, Deborah Beda.
Good morning.
Michael Thompson is also in studio with us. He's a psychologist and co-director of the San Francisco Bay Area Center for Cognitive Therapy. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award for his research on hoarding and cluttering. Good morning, Michael Thompson.
Good morning, Mina.
I want to start with you, Victoria Roberts Russell, if I could. What do we mean by clutter? Is it things that we no longer use, things we no longer have room for? What defines clutter?
I would say you could talk about clutter both from a visual perspective, but also from a more internal perspective. A lot of times you can walk into a room and you can see lots of things, and those things often they're often excessive when you use the word clutter. The difference between clutter and a collection is something that we often examine when we work with our clients. And sometimes clutter is well curated, and that puts it into the perspective of being more socially acceptable even. On the other side of clutter, on the internal side, will our computers get cluttered in the same way on that back side that's not so visible to our outside beings? But the more emotional side is a side that I think Michael Tompkins will help us describe more fully. But all my clients, when they have too much stuff, they also have too much stuff in their heads and in their hearts often. There's often an emotional component to it.
And this distinction you draw between collections and clutter, it's intriguing. And then you bring up this emotional aspect to it. There's been this, you know, Japanese organizer, her name is Marie Kondo, who's basically achieved celebrity status. And it feels like she really brings into this conversation of decluttering that emotional connection. I see, Victoria Roberts Russell, that you have her book. What do we mean when we say the emotional connection in terms of figuring out decluttering?
Well, Marie really has captured an amazing sensibility, I think, about people's things. And I don't know if it's her Japanese, the context from being from Japan, but it does touch so many different kinds of people. And we were just discussing a couple elements of it before we came in. And She does personalize it, and I think, would have us be much more in relationship with the things that we own, so that we're more aware when we no longer love them and they no longer are serving us.
Deborah Bader, are you familiar with her work?
I certainly am, yes, yes. I agree with what Victoria's been saying. I think the mass appeal, and we're talking about this in the green room too, is, you know, it's a beautiful little book. It's very accessible. It's very friendly. It's very light. And there's plenty in there that resonates with people on a very basic level. But if I may, I'd like to say, as with any kind of cultural trend or fad or celebrity, we have to take that with a grain of salt, because like any diet, for example, it's not a one size fits all. And there's a lot of optimism and promise in this book, which I think is great and it resonates with so many people. But it's not for everybody.
So the book is called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying. She also has a new one called Spark Joy, an illustrated masterclass on the art of organizing and tidying up. You, Deborah Bader, when you work with a client, you say that you try to approach them holistically. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? So when you go into a client's home, they're saying they're having a serious problem with cluttering. What do you do?
Well, you know, the first thing is to just talk to them. You know, one of the biggest assets of an organizer is listening to that person. It's the stuff is a symptom, as Victoria was saying, about what's happening inside emotionally. And you really have to look at that person, hear what they're saying, the undertones, and really take in all of that information that you're being fed, and then use that in working with them. Because there is no one size fits all for organizing. Each person's an individual.
And what drives people to accumulate or clutter, Michael Tompkins?
Well, we all like things, and we all have urges to acquire. And so I think, like in any psychological problem, there is a line between what is a normal emotional response and what is a normal behavioral response. And then the line is to when it's not a normal emotional response and not a normal behavioral response. So speaking to the side of the line where it becomes a psychological problem, urges to acquire are so intense that the person cannot resist them, even when the consequences of the acquiring are significant. That makes it a problem. Acquiring in itself, when someone has the urge to buy the newest smartphone and they're able to say, no, I don't think this is a good time, I don't have the money to do it, That's more in the range of what is normal for all of us.
And that's the range that you tend to work in, right, Victoria Roberts Russell?
Of acquirers?
People who have sort of normal levels of acquiring, where they have a lot of things that they would like to clean out, mm-hmm. and, you know, organize.
Right. I tend to work with people with all different levels of volume of things and different times in their lives when they aren't able to manage them. There's so many life events that impact how people are doing in their homes or in their offices. It doesn't take many days of not feeling well physically or mentally for things to really fall off the rails. And people who've had chronic health problems or people who've had a traumatic life event,
have an example?
Oh, my goodness. Well, anybody with fibromyalgia, I would say that's one of my common physical ailments that seems to impact people's their energy. And if you don't have energy, you can't do very much. And it also often involves physical discomfort. And so things you would take for granted, bending over to pick things up to put them away, just are out of their range of ability. And for an organizer to come in, we look at each person, whatever their circumstances, whether it's physical or emotional or depression, and we try to tune their environment so the environment works for where they are right now. If somebody isn't able to bend to pick things up, or they have limitations in their ability to reach higher, we try to organize everything that they really need in a strata that's within their reach. And you can look at that reach both on a physical level, and also Michael can talk about what people are able to reach emotionally.
Deborah Beta, what are some of the other common organizing strategies that you've found useful for clients? I know that they tend to be customized, but for example, you know, making sure that things are within reach can often be, it seems like a no-brainer, but can often be overlooked.
Oh, absolutely. You know, even getting to understand when you talk with a potential client from the get-go is what are their proclivities? You know, trying to determine are they visual individuals? You know, their reason why some people have piles everywhere. Those are the reminders. If things are away, they're going to forget about them. And so to basically organize and work with them in ways in their spaces that actually work with who they are and truly how they need to function and flow in that space physically and energetically in that space.
We're talking with Deborah Beta. She's a professional organizer for Liberated Spaces and has been organizing for 8 years, specializing in green organizing. Also, Victoria Roberts Russell of Victoria Roberts Organizing, also a professional organizer. And Michael Tompkins, a psychologist and co-director of the San Francisco Bay Area Center for Cognitive Therapy. He's an expert in hoarding and cluttering. We want to invite your calls, your cluttering issues. You've got a panel here who can help you strategize ways to address those stubborn spaces in your life. You can call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also tell us about strategies that have worked for you. Are you able to stay successfully organized? Or maybe you had one of those epiphanies or life-changing experiences once you did organize that you'd like to share with us. If you don't want to call, you can email us forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can also post your comments on Facebook or tweet us. Charles writes, I'm a long-haul trucker, out weeks to months at a time. My living space is equivalent to a twin bed, two nightstands, and an overhead storage area that is smaller than a twin bed. In fact, it's the top sleeper area that I use for storage since I drive alone. I battle clutter all the time and lose. My biggest problem is where to put my dirty laundry. I'm pulling my non-existent hair out. Anybody have any thoughts for Trucker Charles? Deborah Beta?
I think part of it would be looking at that space and looking at what's there. That number one is extraneous and what is necessary. You know, when it comes to decluttering a space, one of the first things to creating solutions is how do we weed out what doesn't need to be there? And in that process, space appears magically. And then from there, systems are created.
The conversation that one has with themselves as they're determining that question, though, of what it is that I don't need. You know, we mentioned Marie Kondo earlier. She says to ask yourself, does this item spark joy? What is that something you recommend? And why, if you do you think that's effective? Deborah Beta.
Yeah, that was one of the statements from that book that actually resonated deeply with me, because, you know, when you connect with something that, you know, from an aesthetic value, from a just a personal memento thing, that's important to you. And when there is that joy about something, it has value. It has honor. And I think that is just an important thing to speak to.
Victoria Roberts Russell.
I would add in that the difference between something that sparks joy and something that has no stimulating feeling about it at all is so helpful when we have an environment where the person wants to create change and they don't know how to begin. Just posing the question to them, what do you still really love and find useful? And what do you have here because you either should, somebody gave it to you. There's so many elements in people's homes that come from, my mother gave it to me, so I should keep it. Oh, a friend gave it to me, I should keep it.
Actually, you have the story of a young woman who kept a china cabinet of some kind, but even though it was broken and the glass was broken on it.
Yes, and it's something that she wasn't aware that it had a real impact on her life. She called me with work problems, relationship problems, and a home that you would never want to bring anybody into. It was a small apartment, but it was very disheveled, and there was a lot of trash in it. I think that people can be very proud of bringing someone into a place that's cluttered when it's beautiful things that they love. But when they have things that they don't want, That's when it makes it hard for them to share that part of their lives.
And that, the reason it was broken, too, was because it was given to her from her aunt, and her aunt had been a survivor of domestic abuse.
Yes, and that's exactly right. The story was that she had a piece of furniture in which she was storing sweaters, and it was a little china cabinet, and it had glass doors and glass sides, and all the glass on it was either cracked or missing or part of it missing. So it was kind of a danger as well and was snagging her sweaters. So it was being used for something that it wasn't designed for. I'm all for adapting furniture, but when something is not only not designed for it, but it's also, you know, inappropriate because of its condition in some way, then
it also has this very heavy story.
It's a heavy story because the china cabinet was broken and damaged as a result of domestic abuse, and the woman who had been abused passed this broken piece of furniture onto her beloved niece, and then the niece was having issues that were not good in her life. And when we looked at making her space more peaceful to her, and she recognized that there was so much violence associated with a piece of furniture, when she let that go, she was so relieved. She had no idea that what she had in her home and in her bedroom, a place where you're supposed to have respite from the world, it's a place where your subconscious mind should be able to float freely without fears. And so,
and I think the point that you make about whether we should keep something, we often feel like we should because of sentimental value,
right,
versus whether it actually provides joy, is a good question to be asking ourselves. And we're getting lots of questions right now. Matthew in Pleasanton. Hi, Matthew.
Good morning. I was interested in what could explain the psychology of extreme hoarding with people who are outwardly normal, unless she was a really good actor. I recently rented a room from a woman who her house was literally cluttered with stuff. And one weekend she left, she went out of town, and there were some maintenance issues in the house. And I had to go into her room for the first time. And I had never seen anything like this. I couldn't even walk through her room. There were piles of clothing 5 feet high, and piles of you name it, it was there. And she just seemed so normal to me, and I was really baffled by it.
What is the psychology behind that, Michael Tompkins? Matthew, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, the psychology is actually quite complicated. You know, when we think about a psychological problem, we think about how, in this particular instance, how people's attachments to objects and possessions are so intense that they cannot let go of these items, even items that to others would be of very limited use or value. And the result of that is that the living environments become highly cluttered to the degree that oftentimes the person is at risk for their health and their safety. And so when the level of clutter crosses that line where actually the person is experiencing consequences and impairment in their day-to-day living, we're thinking that it's more than just, you know, someone who has trouble maintaining their space.
And so for anyone wondering, have I crossed this line, that's one of the questions they could ask themselves, is whether or not this is impeding their relationships in some way.
Relationships, or is just getting through the day really, really hard. If you really think about it, living, doing the most mundane routine activities we do on a day-to-day basis, like brushing our teeth, is very complicated when you live in a highly cluttered environment. You can't find your toothbrush. You can't. Maybe the sink doesn't work because you don't have someone in. I mean, and that level of difficulty the person has living on a day-to-day basis is one reason would suggest that this is more than just a bit of clutter.
While we're on the topic, I was curious to get your reaction to these television programs, things that sort of about hoarding and, mm-hmm. and talk about people who struggle with hoarding. It's turned into, to some degree, entertainment. And I wonder if you what effect you think these programs have had in terms of our understanding of hoarding and, you know, for the better or worse.
Mm-hmm. I think these programs are a bit of a double-edged sword. I think that on the one hand, the shows have basically introduced this problem and educated individuals that this is a mental health issue, This isn't about a character flaw. This isn't about people being lazy or dirty or slovenly. This is a mental health issue. That's the good news. And also, many of these shows meet people when they're at a crisis, that they're going to lose their children, they're going to lose their relationship, they're going to lose their home, and they don't have the money or the manpower to solve that problem. And so the shows come in with that money and that manpower and actually can relieve that crisis. Right? The downside is that the stories can be such that there's too much entertainment value, and people begin to look at it as viewers begin to look at it as entertainment as opposed to, like, this is a real mental health issue.
And let's go to more calls. Robert in Berkeley. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I had a related question. My mother is a hoarder, and it's been a struggle for 30 years. And we as a family haven't made a lot of headway with it. And just wondering what some strategies are to help a person struggling with hoarding, particularly a parent who may struggle to see the situation for what it is, mm-hmm. to help that person out of that situation.
Thanks, Robert.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Michael Tompkins, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. This is the most common and I think actually most frustrating aspect of someone who has a hoarding disorder, which is their reluctance or absolute adamant refusal to accept help. I think it's very frustrating for family members, particularly when their loved one is living in a very often unsafe environment. And then in an effort to help the loved one, the relationships get really distressed because there's a lot of pushing. Sometimes there's a lot of shouting. There's arguments about the stuff over and over again. And that, again, then result in the loved one kind of like pulling out, closing the door. So my advice, the only leverage really one has as a family member is the quality of the relationship you have with your mother. And so I would say a starting point is if that relationship has been damaged over the years because of these relentless arguments about stuff, I would start by trying to repair the relationship. Once the relationship is repaired and there's a more positive aspect in that, then there will be opportunities to work with her about trying to set some goals that really focus on her safety and first and comfort second, and just try to help her live more safely and comfortably in her home as opposed to trying to help her live in a home that you would like her to live in.
We're going to continue our conversation with Michael Tompkins, psychologist and co-director of the San Francisco Bay Area Center for Cognitive Therapy. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award for his research on hoarding and cluttering. We're also going to be continuing our conversation with Victoria Roberts Russell, professional organizer with Victoria Roberts Organizing, and Deborah Beda, a professional organizer with Liberated Spaces, who also specializes in green organizing. Give us a call with your questions or comments about clearing out those stubbornly messy spaces, about the psychology behind accumulation or even purging. You can call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. More after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking decluttering this hour with Victoria Roberts Russell and Deborah Beda, professional organizers, and also with psychologist Michael Tompkins. We've got lots of questions and comments coming in. Let me start with taking your calls. Let's go to Claudia in Sebastopol. Go ahead, Claudia.
Hello. Thank you so much to each and every one of you for your help and comments. I was retired and am still, and I'm an elder. I was in a 3,500-square-foot home that to me, was a living album of my life's work and here in the States and abroad in fundraising. I'd been able to travel, and I only had things in my home that were beautiful that I loved, and it was in order. I loved to have people over. I had a house fire. I lost it all. I then was rear-ended, and so now I'm one of those people that you talked about who can't bend or reach. I then had emergency cardiovascular surgery 4 months ago, and so cannot for sure lift now, cannot get into even the fridge. And yet, I have to go back to work, because the finances are now completely drained. I'm in a room now that's less than 200 square feet without beautiful things, and I'm so lost. I am so very lost. I don't know how to live in a minimal space, and yet I know it's becoming vogue for many.
Wow.
And perhaps there are other elders out there or just people who've had a sequence of events like this, but who really want to have a foundation from which to relaunch themselves.
Well, Claudia,
back
thanks.
Into the world.
Let's get Victoria Roberts Russell on that.
Hi, Claudia. I empathize with you greatly, and I believe that because you are so aware and you have a good foundation for what feeds your soul, and I would really encourage you to make this new space a precious little jewel box for yourself. And with that, I think it will help you also with the effort you now have to make for finding work in the outside world. And I always encourage my clients who have special talents and visual skills, as you sound like you do, to maybe focus on that as an opportunity for you to also find work, because you're probably talented in that area. But when we have to work with a very small space, one of the main things that we discover is that the footprint of a piece of furniture, you have to get the maximum out of it. So you don't want just a two-drawer dresser, for instance, for one reason, because you couldn't use the lower drawers anyway. But in small spaces, you have to go up. And so that's one of the things when helping people select furniture is making sure that it is appropriate for providing the most that it can for your needs. And I would just work with a client like you to find out what truly is needed. What is your basic toiletry kit that really serves you well, and how can that be most easily presented for your use? You probably don't need a set of 12 dishes any longer, so your cupboard space can be modified to handle what you really do use. There are just lots of little ways of tuning things down in volume, and also taking advantage of the opportunity to use the square footage the most efficiently.
Claudia, thanks so much for the call, Claudia. Let's go to Cheyenne in Hayward. Hi, Cheyenne.
Hello. Thank you. First of all, I'm desperate for help. Me and my husband are both teachers, and I found, along with the resources we've kept from college that we thought would be helpful while we're teaching in our disciplines, we also have accumulated a lot of resources via professional development, via our students' work, samples that we want to keep, and it's just...
Sounds like you have a lot of paper in your house.
Yeah, paper and books that I don't know, in bags and in old backpacks and in stacks, and now we have two children under five, so it's a very unsettling place to come home to, and I'm not sure how to manage it, because there are things that we'd like to keep, but like... I don't know what to do.
Yeah, Cheyenne.
It just seems crazy. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Cheyenne, thanks so much. And there are several others who've written in about paper and paperwork and books. So, Deborah Beta?
Thank you. Thank you for your call, Cheyenne. That is a very common predicament amongst many of our clients. And when it comes to paper, you know, and things that could be useful and may be useful, there's a point in time where it's important to go through and assess what's there. And that could be everything from literally going through like each book, each paper, if there are journals, for example, are they available online? Are those books available in a library, some other resource, or in some kind of electronic format that you can access if you need them? When it comes to other, you know, student work that you've been accumulating, do you photograph them or have them scanned and digitized so that you have some kind of an archive or collection that isn't a physical mass, but actually lightens that paper and publication volume in your home?
Victoria Roberts-Russell, did you want to add something about paperwork?
I would like to add something about teachers. All the teachers I've known have been very, I'm not sure if the word is altruistic or not, but they're so... loving of sharing information and wanting to provide the very best facts and things they've discovered. So they're reluctant to lose great information. So we want to capitalize on that. And Deborah did push the buttons about scanning things, taking photographs of things. children's artwork decays so rapidly. People discover, you know, bins of things their kids did 25 years later, and the paper's all crispy and not very nice. And I have seen the beautiful things people can do with digital images and then having them reproduced, and they look like real art. But the information, the desire to have good information is complex. And I would also like to hear what Michael has to say about people's relationship psychologically with information that may be useful, because I think it goes to both sides.
Well, yes. Well, paper is the number one thing that people collect. And what might be helpful is for the person before they start a decluttering project to kind of establish some rules, some keep rules and some let go rules. And like Victoria's, one rule is, like, I don't keep paper that is soiled. I don't keep paper that is torn. I don't keep paper that is crinkly. Setting up timelines for items, because we keep certain papers for certain periods of time. And so some papers we keep forever, like the mortgage to your home, for example. But ATM receipts and things like that could be discarded the next day.
Andy writes, I'm not a huge acquirer of stuff by American standards, but I'm moving to Europe. My biggest hang-up is rebuying things and how inefficient that is because of the financial hit you take. How do I get over that? I need to get rid of a lot of things.
eBay.
Victoria Roberts Russell, eBay. And Linda writes, my clutter usually involves papers, clippings that could potentially provoke ideas for my writing, also art supplies, and then clothes I should try to sell. But the logistics of that tire me before I begin. Do guests have suggestions?
Yes, yes, indeed. You know, when it comes to stuff sitting around, there's deferred decision making, and finding the time to do the decluttering and getting rid of things. And I think for everybody, there needs to be a looking at what is your threshold. You know, this has been sitting here for 2 months. Am I actually going to sell it? Or would it be easier and the shortest, most direct path to give it away? And for every individual, it's up to you to decide what your threshold is and what feels best for you to help you move forward.
Kenneth shares this tip. Invite a special friend or relative to your office or home and be prepared to allow them to view the entire space. And if you care, you will declutter. My girlfriend visited my house for the first time in months this week, and it never looked better. What do you think of that strategy?
I think it's a great strategy. There's also, you know, I have clients who will tell me that, okay, I've got a deadline. I know you're coming. I'm going to clean up before you come. And some get to a point where they don't need to. I think it depends on a comfort level. A lot of our clients, they have house guests coming. There's that closet down the hall. Things get put in bags in that closet. They get put in the extra bedroom. So really, for, you know, once again, for everybody, there's a different approach. If you have the time and the bandwidth and the energy to do that tidying and decluttering, more power to you. It's great. It's a great habit and practice.
Well, Deborah Beta, how do you stay organized in your life? What are the small things you do to make sure things don't get out of control?
Good question. Honestly, I do literally a reset every day. Before I shut down my office and my computer at home for the day, I actually clean my desktop. I come back to my office in the morning. There's my keyboard, my trackpad, and there's my calendar, my little pile of papers. That's it. I need to come back to a clean palette. Same thing goes with laundry. I can't leave laundry on the floor. It has to go in the basket in the closet. The kitchen sink. Yeah, there are the occasional times where it's, you know, you're tired and you don't want to do the dishes, but I love having the empty sink when I wake up in the morning and having that fresh palette every day.
So it's like a combination of what you know gives you joy when you wake up in the morning. But also, so in cleaning out your desk, how long does that take you when you do it, the reset?
Oh, 3 to 5 minutes.
And why so short?
Why so short? There's not much there to begin with.
Every day.
Every day. Keeping on top of it. Mm-hmm.
And everything has a place. Victoria mm-hmm. Roberts Russell.
Generally speaking, people always ask organizers, you know, your house must be perfect. And I will say it is often not perfect, but it doesn't take long to put things back because they do have a designated place. And I'm pretty loyal to that. Because I see every single day when I work how unhappy an environment feels when there is no place to put things. And so I know how vulnerable we all are. It's so easy for things to come into our lives, either gifted or in the mail or whatever. So I think being very loyal to routines of tidying saves me. And we also see how bad it can be, and we're kept aware of the slippery slope, I'd say, on a daily basis.
But that's not to say, I mean, there are plenty of organizers, like any individual, that are not tidy. You know, we often can go into a home and help somebody else very easily. But in our own lives, because of the same issues some of our clients might have. There can be, you know, emotional clutter. There can just be all sorts of issues, life transitions or illness or other things going on where maybe the house isn't what someone would imagine a model organizer's home to look like. Mm-hmm. Because you know what? In the end of the day, we're all people too.
True. P writes, this was Kondo's biggest relationship revelation for me, which referring to Marie Kondo. Organize for ease of putting back, not for easy retrieval. And Diana writes, the most valuable bit of decluttering / reorganizing advice for me is from flylady.net. Clean your sink. This refers to something you said, Deborah Beta. I don't have a dishwasher, so it can be daunting. But nevertheless, a clean sink is a piece of order, calm, and sanity. And again, getting back to that emotional. Nora in Sunnyvale. Hi, Nora.
Hi, Nora. Hi, sorry, it's Nora. Many of my questions were answered already, but I do have a question of if I'm trying to get organized. I moved into a space after intense schooling with my child, and I'm realizing I haven't had people over because of the clutter. And I'm wondering, what do you do when the anxiety of getting rid of things comes up, even with clothes, where it might come back into style? I don't have the money to replace it. What can you do when you really have the desire to get tidy, but that anxiety comes up? And also when folks come over, the anxiety of, is it clean enough? Is it presentable enough? How perfect does it need to be?
Nora, thanks. Victoria Roberts Russell?
I like to use the term organized enough, and I think that an organized environment is one you can be happy in. So work to the degree that you create an environment that you and your daughter are happy, and people will be attracted to you no matter what if they can see you both are happy and healthy and are living a good, full life. For me, organizing is all about preparing an environment that allows you to live a full and fulfilling life, and that's its only purpose, really.
So perfect is almost the enemy of the good. Organized enough is the mm-hmm. not perfect organization.
Absolutely.
And to speak to the question about, you know, clothes and the anxiety of getting rid of things, you know, part of that is looking at what is the space that you have? What can you reasonably allocate for those items? And once again, what is enough? If you have a pair of jeans that you've been carrying around for 10 years and you've not worn them, is it okay to let them go? And these are some questions to ask. And sometimes...
Do you, Deborah Beta, recommend, like Marie Kondo, to take the item in your hand and feel it? Like you can't just...
For some people that might work. For some people...
To help them determine.
Yeah, for some people where there are attachment issues when I work with them, I will have them sit in one spot, and I actually hold up the object, so they don't have that tactile relationship to it, and they have a little bit of actual physical distance, and they can make decisions very differently than feeling it and smelling it and having that interaction.
Therese writes, how can I help my 11-year-old daughter avoid cluttering habits? My daughter appears to have emotional attachments to the wrapping paper of her favorite present, still keeps her baby toys, etc. I tend to remove such items when she's not home, but I want her to want to learn to live in decluttered space without having an argument. My room is not cluttered, our living space is clear, so the example is there, but she does not seem to have a desire to have that in her room. Michael Tompkins?
What you might do is... set up an incentive system for letting go, one. And so when I work with kids who have a problem like this, we have incentives for spontaneous gifts to others, you know, leaving things for other people, giving things to other people, and incentivizing that with a token economy, but it's based upon the economy is based upon experiences, not things. So, you know, going out for pizza with a friend or something. So an incentive system to help the kid be willing to tolerate the emotional, the emotions that are going to come up for letting go. Also setting up like forced choice containers where the kid can keep all the toys that will fit into a particular box. And and then when a toy doesn't fit into the box any longer, to ask them to select a toy and then give them a reward for letting go of it.
Hmm. Michael Tompkins, psychologist and co-director of San Francisco Bay Area Center for Cognitive Therapy, who received a Lifetime Achievement Award for his research on hoarding and cluttering. We're also talking with Victoria Roberts Russell of Victoria Roberts Organizing and Deborah Beda of Liberated Spaces. A listener writes, I live in a really small space, but I have several craft hobbies which require tons of stuff. I knit and crochet, so I have tons of yarn. I had a jewelry business, which I just put on hold at the end of 2015, so I have lots of jewelry making supplies. I want to make my home more homey and spacious, but I also want to keep my hobby things because they bring me so much joy, and I don't know how to reconcile these two things. Thanks so much to this listener. Hobby things, I bet this is something that comes up quite a bit. You'd like to take that.
Victoria, you're giggling over there. I think
is this something you see a lot, Victoria Roberts Russell?
We can all speak to this.
But please go ahead.
Well, I know my most creative clients are the clients who are the most fun, and they are also the most challenging because all of these crafts and creative pursuits have materials. And generally we end up working down to what are the realities? What can you do in your lifetime? Is this enough beads for you to share? Because you can never have time to make that much jewelry. And do you run out of interest at any point? It's like you kind of look at what's realistic for you. And nobody has the answer but my client. So I'm not coming into it judging that they can only have this much. But you look at the constraints of the space, and if they're constantly having to work to create space to work in, their stuff is getting in the way of having a good life. It all goes back to putting it through the filter of how can you have a better life?
How much of a role does storage, organizing equipment, storage stuff, how much of that is part of your solution? Often I find that I don't want to buy more plastic bins to put more things in, even though it might help me organize something. Is storage equipment or organizing equipment essential, or do you often find that there are ways to get around that, Deborah Beda?
Oh, there are definitely ways to get around it. As I was saying earlier, organizing starts not with buying something, but really let's triage down what you've got. What I often find, and I'm sure Victoria as well can speak to this too, once you really distill a space, suddenly a lot of space is there and empty containers present themselves and empty boxes. There are plenty of opportunities for reuse and appropriation of other pieces of furniture or just surprising ways to use things. And it's important to be creative at times. You know, I'm very mindful of client budgets and whatnot. And a lot of people don't want to buy things. But for those who do, if there's a certain aesthetic, if they don't want to see things, they want, you know, an opaque container, then we'll look at those solutions. But really buying new things is definitely at the end. That's the reward if someone needs it.
And that's so interesting that you say that, because I find that people who end up organizing their space and finding that they have more space suddenly then say, okay, now I can go out and buy that thing that I wanted to buy because I have the space for it. Michael Tompkins, what kind of dialogue should people be having with themselves in the stores or online before they click purchase?
You know, that's a really terrific point. And is that what I would ask is, like, what value is the acquiring really serving, you know? And is it just the thing, or is it sometimes for many people what they choose to acquire brings something into their lives, such as, you know, the creativity that comes with acquiring hobby supplies, for example. And you know, really pay attention to that and then look for alternatives to feed that value that don't include a thing, right? Because the things that really bring meaning and happiness in our lives are the values, and oftentimes these values are for friendship and intimacy and creativity. But there are lots of ways to satisfy a value like that without a thing.
And it's so hard, though. I mean, consumerism. We're constantly being told to get more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So how do is there more to fight that besides the strategy that you just mentioned?
Well, I think that. One of the things that is really important, I was thinking about what the caller was saying about the anxiety about letting go of clothing. What I recommend people do is do experiments around those emotions. So to let go of an item and see, one, how intense is the anxiety? How intense is the urge to acquire? How intense is the loss, the feelings of loss? And how long does it take before that feeling starts to decrease? Because a lot of what keeps us from doing things that result in an emotional reaction is our prediction about how anxious we're going to be, how long we're going to think about that item, how long we're going to miss that item. And doing experiments to actually test that out is very, very helpful, because what we learn is actually it's not as hard as it feels like it's going to be.
Irene writes, do you find the challenges for organizing device spaces, such as online photo collections, hard drives, emails, etc., similar to the challenges of managing physical spaces? Are the decluttering strategies similar? Deborah Beta.
Yes, they are. Even though I don't do an extensive amount of electronic organizing per se with my clients, you know, when somebody often wants to, for example, you know, create files on their computer, I have all these documents, and they have a physical file there. There's a real mimic in the digital world for organizing as you have in the physical world. So there are very similar approaches and strategies to take in terms of creating structure and parameters and containment. You know, where are my files going to live? Are they going to be on a hard drive? Are they going to be on a cloud? What's going to serve me best? So there are all different kinds of choices and discussions to have around that.
Ralph writes, it's important to remember the impact on the environment of throwing stuff out. There's always someone less fortunate who could use something that you no longer take an interest in. Use services like Craigslist or FreeCycle to give things away for free. And Deborah Beta, this is something that you look at too. What are some strategies for the most common decluttering projects to make them green?
Right. Well, people think about green organizing or environmentally conscious organizing as, you know, we're going to reduce, reuse, and recycle, which are great. And most people are aware of that. A lot of organizers practice that. The other piece of that is the responsibility that we have and that our clients have. You know, people hold on to clutter because they often can't determine the right destination for something. They don't want it to go into landfill. They want to be responsible citizens and stewards of objects and possessions. And as such, I've made it a point in my practice to really form relationships with various local nonprofits. So, for example, I'm a community partner with Goodwill of San Francisco, San Mateo Marin. They're a great resource for a lot of people. The donations go into their program, and people are being trained in their programs. We have Your Neighbor Here in the neighborhood, a homeless prenatal program. They're a group that will actually give donations away to their clients. So having resources like these and creative reuse centers, we can really help guide people to giving things away much more easily when they know it has a home to go to.
We just have a few minutes left. Let me try to get one more call in here. Valerie from Los Altos. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. So my parents passed away about 12 years ago, and I spent a couple of months clearing out their house. And there were a number of items that I couldn't bear to part with at the time. Both my parents were prolific writers, so a lot of letters and even greeting cards that they would write poetry on and so forth. And so I have them all organized in plastic boxes labeled in a back closet. And 12 years later, whenever I go into the closet and I take out one box and I spend a half hour, and I just get, it's just too draining, and then I put it back and I close the closet door. And, you know, so I'm trying to figure out sort of how can I go through it, you know, because it's just, it's such an intense experience. You know, or should I just leave it for my children to deal with someday? So
Valerie, thanks. Michael Tompkins?
Well, I think that actually the best approach would be for you to set some limits about how much time you actually do that. And so, and try not to work past what your real emotional limit is. And oftentimes for people, the emotional limits is 30 minutes or less is typically the...
We have one last question from Rob that I'd like to end on. He's wondering about free online resources that outlines the basic principles of organizing spaces. His garage, he says, is a disorganized disaster. Any free online resources you can recommend?
We're scratching our chins
here.
Okay,
well, if we do, we'll post them on our website. And also, just one last question for anyone who'd like to take it. This weekend, we're going to go stand in front of our closet or our bedroom or something. What's the first thing that somebody should do if they're getting ready to tackle a decluttering project? What's the first step they can take this weekend?
Make sure you've eaten a good meal before you get started and have a neutral, non-judgmental friend or family member to support you as you review the contents, because often we need some outside feedback.
I like that. Victoria Roberts Russell of Victoria Roberts Organizing, thanks so much. Thank you, Deborah Beta, as well, professional organizer with Liberated Spaces. And thanks to Michael Tompkins, psychologist and co-director of the San Francisco Bay Area Center for Cognitive Therapy. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Don Clyde. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive director is Joanne Wallace. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.